Welcome to Trillo Talk. This is a podcast dedicated to topics that we think are important to the profession of medical writing. And our goal is to bring topical issues to the forefront and hopefully spark conversations in the wider domain about these issues.
Welcome to today's podcast and a very big welcome to a very good friend of mine, Dr. Art Gattell. Thank you for joining me, Art. And we are going to talk today a bit about patient centricity that I know is very, very dear to both of our hearts. So I'd like to start off, maybe let's start with the basics for our listeners. For those who are new to our podcast or to the industry, let's think about how you would define the term patient centricity and maybe think about how often we encounter this term in our work and in the discussions with the pharmacists.
Well, thank you. As you said, this is a topic that is near and dear to my heart because you and I both share a membership on the MRCT Plain Language Task Force, and that has a goal of providing information to people who might not be as well versed in the science and medicine technical language that we live in. And so to engage patients and engage the general public in the process of research and development and bringing molecules to medicines, which is something we're all engaged in, it's very important to make sure that the patient voice is heard. And very often people think, well, it's about putting the patient at the center, but that's not really what it is. It's really making sure that the patient needs are at the center. And in order for us to best understand what those needs are, we have to open up channels of communication. And those channels of communication need to be enhanced by understandable language. So, yes, we need to engage the patient. And we need to make sure that they are engaged at appropriate points of time in the decisions that are being made about developing new medicines. Now, very often in the pharmaceutical industry, you hear, oh, patient centricity. We want to make sure that the patient is being engaged in key elements of bringing these molecules to medicines. But I've been in the industry a long time, either directly as an employee or as someone who provides strategic regulatory consulting to the industry. And I rarely, if ever, see patients sitting in the same room when the initial discussions are taking place about the strategic decisions of developing new medicines. And so I think that, yes, we often hear the term, it's a buzz phrase, but in terms of practical applied patient engagement, I really haven't seen it very often, particularly at the early stages. Where you most often see the patients is at the later stages when the commercial interests are brought to bear and how can we best approach the patient community to adopt our new therapies.
So drive demand.
Drive the product.
Exactly. Yeah, I think you make brilliant points, as always, Art, and I totally agree. And certainly I've seen, I don't want to be unkind and say it's the level of tokenism, because I genuinely believe that everyone I've encountered in the pharmaceutical industry, and like you, I've been doing this for a long time, they all genuinely want to do the right thing and are trying to do the best by patients, 100%. But that's very different. So understanding conceptually what patient centricity is and believing that that's a good thing is very different from operationally making that happen. And I think part of that is there's been a fear because pharma is not traditionally meant to be engaging with patients. And if they do, there are a lot of rules and regulations quite rightly around that. And also a kind of a lack of really trying to work out how that they can make this happen. And I think that's where perhaps as medical writers, we can help facilitate that a little bit and certainly kind of fight against the tokenism side. I was really interested particularly in what something you said about we are seeing patients being brought in, but it's at the later stages. And that goes back to the comment that you made about there's a difference between putting the patient's voice in the equation and putting their needs in the equation. Because by the time they're brought in at the later stages, as you say, very often to kind of have brand acceptance and drive brand awareness, all of the clinical studies are done by that point, right? By definition, we're just rolling it out. And I really think that patients have so much more to give if they're brought in much earlier, as you say, and can actually add to the strategic part of clinical development. So how would you say that if you had a crystal ball, or not a crystal ball, a magic wand, you already have a crystal ball. So say I'm giving you a magic wand. What would you love to do or see done to enable that, to enable patients to be brought in at the start of clinical development, the strategic side of things? And how would you advise pharma to go about doing that?
Yeah, and I think that you point out something very important, which is this sense of almost arrogance that the industry has that, well, we know best for what the patient needs. We are deep in the weeds of the therapeutic options and the metabolic profile and how this thing is absorbed and what the unmet clinical needs are. If we start to bring patients into the mix, it's going to just slow us down. We're going to have to explain things. We're going to have to provide justification for the strategies that we believe are the most effective. Yeah. And as you know, time pressure is incredible in the pharmaceutical industry. There are a lot of pressures, particularly in public companies, where they need to answer to the shareholders every quarter and show what advances have been made towards regulatory review, approval, and commercialization. So when you have these pressures, it's very difficult to get the teams to set aside time to bring in parties that they don't view as being co-equals. So yeah, there is this paternalism, there is this arrogance, there's this sense of we know best, and almost a paternalism in loco parentis feel to the whole thing. So to get back to your question, which is how do we best engage the patient? We traditionally, we meaning the pharmaceutical industry, has traditionally engaged their surrogates. And those are usually the physicians, the subject matter experts, and even in some cases, patient advocacy groups. But going directly to the patient is something that is really rare. And so I think that we may be able to effectively go through some of those points of contact to actually engage the individual patients, understanding that not these patients are not monolithic, that every patient does not have the same perspective in terms of what's important to them. Yeah. We already engage in different levels of pain tolerance, for example, where some patients are more or less willing to accept discomfort if it means that they're going to get a therapeutic advantage. Yes. I've seen that in many cases where I've worked on oncology products that have pain upon administration, abdominal administration of very viscous fluid as a vehicle. And some patients say, there's no way I'm going to subject myself to these large bore syringes abdominally. And yeah. Other patients say, if it gets me through my six cycles of chemotherapy, I'm willing to put up with acute pain because it brings the hope that I will be able to survive this disease. And so you get the bell curve no matter where you go. And understanding that we do have this variability in perception of need, perception of consequence, it's still important, I think, to go to individual patients and maybe select people by virtue of a questionnaire. What are your greatest needs? What are your greatest fears? What are your greatest hopes for this potential treatment for your disease, and use that as a screening tool to select representative patients who may act as cohorts for these subpopulations within the community. So maybe that's a way to better engage them, not just go out and randomly pick a name from a hat and say, what do you need? But do a pre-selection through patient advocacy groups, through oncology healthcare providers, for example, and have them be the vehicle through which we contact a representative population of patients.
I think that's a fantastic idea. And certainly when I've been working with pharma as an independent consultant, trying to bridge that gap between the pharmaceutical company and the patient advocacy group. And I've reached out to patient advocacy groups for their input on a wide range of different documents and initiatives. I've never, ever had a negative experience, quite the reverse, actually. And I always heartily encourage both pharma and individual medical writers to reach out to patient advocacy groups within the bounds of the codes of conduct, obviously. Right. I don't think, you know, neither of us would be saying patient medical writers should just be reaching out willy-nilly to patient advocates on behalf of pharma companies, because, yeah, you could get yourself into quite a lot of hot water that way. But certainly it's a really viable and valid route to reach out to patients for their input. And what you said is absolutely correct. You know, I think as healthcare professionals always have a view on what they think is acceptable to patients, but everyone's benefit risk assessment and ratio is different. And there's a lot of literature out there saying that what we think as healthcare professionals a patient would accept is often vastly different from the reality. So it's well worth reaching out to patients and getting their opinion for a whole load of reasons beyond the fact that obviously just the information side of things. And then obviously we're it's a whole separate podcast to talk about diversity and inclusion and the impact of, inclusion and exclusion criteria in clinical trials and all of that side of things. And I'm sure we will be talking in the future about diversity and inclusion in clinical trials moving forwards. But that's certainly a really, really crucial aspect.
And it's also critical to understand that not all populations are representative. When you go from geographical location to geographical location, and cultural differences in terms of expectations, financial coverage. I mean, all of these things differ from place to place. Socialized medicine, access to medicines, transportation medicines in terms of temperature and humidity control. I mean, all of these things play a part in how viable these medications are going to be once they achieve market approval.
Absolutely. And even just getting there. So to go back to your bell curve, all of those things actually skew the bell curve during the clinical development process. So the whole point of clinical development is to see how the medicines are going to react in a population, but actually the vast majority of them aren't even tested on the full population. So there's a lot of assumptions and extrapolations and modeling that happens to try and work out the full impact in the population. And okay, in an ideal world, we would test all medicines on a whole ton more of people that we currently do, but there are very, very sensible restrictions and realistic restrictions. But I still think we can do better than we're doing now.
Yeah, and we've seen recent examples, for example, with COVID vaccine transportation. You have politics. You have the ability to refrigerate a product and deliver it to the point of administration. If you had a patient population in sub-Saharan Africa and you have to worry about unnavigable roads and refrigerated trucks, all of these things. And these are things that don't often come into the mix. But there is a situation where you should have someone whose feet are on the ground in the point of administration to be able to say, have you thought about this? How are you going to get this medication to the patient?
Yep. And I remember when I was a long time ago now doing my PhD, which was in vaccine research. And at the time, the WHO, it was the height of the HIV problem. And the WHO at the time were saying, please, can you look at vaccines that do not require a needle to be administered? Yeah. And we did a lot of research on nasally, you know, inhaled vaccines to try and get away from needle stick problems because of the HIV side of things. So, yeah, I think it's well worth speaking to people on the ground who are going to be directly affected or are directly using the medicines to kind of get their input, for sure.
Yeah. And that's where that very early engagement is so important, because that's when you're discussing formulation.
Absolutely.
If is it going to be a tablet? Is it going to be injectable? How is it going to be administered? Is it going to be topical? And these are things that the patient can give input into, because, again, if you can't administer it and you can't get it to the point of administration, it's ineffective.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I remember discussing with a client, they had a solution they wanted to give orally. And it was very, very viscous, very thick. But it was going to be for an elderly population. It was to help with dementia and some dyskinesia, I believe, if I remember correctly. And they got quite far down the track before someone said, you know, they're going to have problems swallowing this. This is, you know, they're likely immobile. This is going to be a real issue. And no one had thought of that, because you're focused on different things as scientists, right? And for very good reason. But it's the sheer practicalities that often you could save a whole load of time and effort and money if they were considered earlier on. So there's lots of really, really good reasons for doing this.
And there may be populations that are inaccessible as direct conversations, but for whom a surrogate may be the most appropriate point of contact. And that could be, for example, someone who works in a nursing home among patients who are cognitively challenged. Who can't communicate their needs and can't communicate their wishes. But these are the people who are their caregivers, are well aware of some of the issues of administration and compliance and all the other things that we worry about. And the same is true of pediatric population, where you have kids who they can't tell you, I hate the smell of this drug.
Or the taste, we've had that before, where it got way through to final phase and the kids wouldn't take it because they hated the taste.
Exactly. Yeah. But their mothers will know.
Yeah.
You know, little Johnny refuses to take this because he says it tastes terrible.
Yeah. How many kids like aniseed, for example, or licorice, that kind of thing. Right. Yeah, absolutely. So unfortunately, we don't have magic wands. I can't give you one, Alt. I'm sorry.
Batteries have run out on mine.
We'll get that renewed, don't worry. We are lowly medical writers. So what role do you think that we could play in actually advocating for and helping this side of things, patient engagement and their access to information?
Well, medical writers are in a critical place in the pathway. We prepare materials that are at the very beginning. So whether it's an investigator's brochure, which brings together preclinical data, for example, or literature searches and summaries, you know, these are often prepared before you even put together your clinical program to develop your product. Yep. So that is a point of potential value of the medical writer as educator. Use the fact that you understand the pathway of documentation to engage your team. And most pharma companies have these matrix environments where you have representatives from each of the disciplines with whom you work. And very often they're naive. They have a very blinkered view of how drugs get through the process. And I think that medical writers are one of the few professions that have a much broader contextual view of the entire process. And so they can see both the initial genesis points of these documents and also the end product, which is a dossier that is submitted to a regulator to get commercial approval. And then beyond, for publications, post-approval submissions. There are all kinds of things. So the medical writer is in a very good position to open up the blinkers and to say, in order for us to optimize the development of a product, we need to be aware of the gap analysis of the development of these products. And those gaps are represented by patient needs. Mm-hmm. And so the medical writer can instill that sense of commitment to the patient in the team, because they will have heard the corporate motivational posters. Patient comes first, to patient engagement, patient centricity. They've heard these words. But from an applied perspective, they have no idea, A, why it's important, B, is it feasible, and C, how they can be a part of the process of getting that patient need incorporated into the development plan. So I think the medical writers can be, in a sense, surrogates for the patients. They can be advocates for the patients, and they can be teachers for their teammates.
That's perfect. And I think we're going to pick this up in part two of this podcast, Art, because as always, I could speak to you for hours about this. But for now, I think that's a good place to pause. And I hope we will see all our listeners back here for part two of this podcast. Dr. Gertel, Art, thank you so much for all your time and for sharing your infinite wisdom with me, with our podcast listeners. And I will see you all here back for part two. Thank you very much.
Lisa. And as you know, I can pontificate on anything. So time just flies.
There's so many
potential topics that we could cover, and it never ends. But thank you for the conversation.
My pleasure.
So thank you for listening to Trilla Talk today. If you enjoyed it, please come back and listen to us again. If you have feedback on this or any of our sessions, we would love to hear it. In addition, if you have ideas for future topics that you'd like us to cover, particularly something you think the community should be talking about, let us know. We would like this to be an ongoing conversation with medical writers at large, and you can send us comments on our Twitter feed or on our LinkedIn page. Just a reminder, you can find all our episodes of the Trilla Talk podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and trilogywriting.com/Trillotalk. Have a good rest of your day.